Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Burst of Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California. The show is sponsored by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm features organic coffee and milks, vegan sandwiches, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found online at firestormcafe.com. Archives of past interview episodes of The Final Straw can be found on thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. And you can find archives of past music episodes on archive.org and Radio for All by searching Final Straw Asheville FM. The show airs every Sunday on Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org, at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And if you have any concerns, questions, criticisms, or critiques, feel free to send them to us at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. We're speaking with Leslie James Pickering about his recent and not-so-recent harassment by all levels of law enforcement in the United States. Thanks for speaking, Leslie.
Oh, glad to be here.
So for those who don't recognize your name, can you talk a little bit about some of the projects that you've been involved with over the years that have gained you some notoriety with law enforcement?
I guess I'm kind of best known for being a spokesperson for the Earth Liberation Front Press Office. That was an organization that existed to help educate the public on what the Earth Liberation Front was doing and why. And the Earth Liberation Front was an underground organization that commits illegal actions, direct action, sabotage types of actions in defense of the environment. And during the years when I was involved at the press office, which was probably from around 1997 through 2002, the Earth Liberation Front was a very active underground organization that was causing hundreds of millions of dollars in damages to corporations and government entities that were profiting off the destruction of the environment, and they were listed as the FBI's number one domestic terrorist priority.
And yet they didn't contribute to any human or animal deaths that anyone's aware of, right?
No, not at all. They're all property crimes, sabotage, damage of property. Their goal was to cause economic losses to companies that were profiting from environmental devastation, so they would typically burn down a building that would maybe be a corporate headquarters for a certain company, or maybe a logging lumber mill, or maybe a lot full of SUVs, something like that.
I hear communiques and hear reports about ELF, or Earth Liberation Front, actions in different parts of the world. I don't hear as much about the United States. Were you receiving much in the way of, or presenting much in the way of ELF communiques from outside of the United States during that period of time?
Not much. I mean, the sort of story behind the foundation of the Earth Liberation Front, I don't really have any idea how accurate this is, but the concept is that it really started in Britain and then came over to the U.S., and there were some actions over there before, it came over to the U.S., but it's really hard to find information on any of those, especially compared to the early U.S. actions, the ones that I was representing in the media, because those actions between 97 and 2002 or so were very high profile, they caused a lot of damages, and they were very increasingly frequent. Some of them were, the top news story for weeks on end across the country. And other ones were definitely the biggest thing that's happened in that area for, a decade or more. So these were pretty high-profile, large-scale actions, and there weren't many of them happening outside of the U.S. at that point. But since then, in the U.S., it's gotten less and less frequent, and outside certain areas outside the U.S., you see more and more Earth Liberation Front activity. So during the period that I was running the press office, we would, during the most intense period, I would say that there was maybe a significant ELS action every month and a half to 2 months, and it would cause on average, $1.5 to $2 million in damages. And these news stories kind of feed off each other, and the attention that the group gets and the popularity the group, enjoys, so to speak, they build off each other. So, there was $1 million action against Boise Cascade 1 month, and then another $1 million action against Monsanto, 3 weeks later, it just kind of escalates and escalates, and before you know it, you have a very intense situation.
According to some of the public documents that the ELF has published about why they do and what they do and how you get involved in it, that seemed to be a part of it was reproducibility and and the idea that it would escalate more and more actions, right?
Definitely was the idea. You know, the concept is that the ELF is just a part of a larger sort of, you know, freedom struggle, struggle to protect the environment and all of us who live here on Earth. And, you know, anyone can join up, anyone can do this. This is, you just follow these guidelines and, you know, and do your actions. And then we were there as the press office, just as a, because if you're committing these illegal activities, you can't come forward and say, hey, I did this and this is why, without getting arrested and taken off to jail. So, you know, we had just set up sort of like a media clearinghouse so people could send their communiques claiming action, claiming responsibility for certain actions, and send them to us, and then we would, you know, build a press network and alert people across the country as to what happened and why. We also produced our own media on a regular basis, videos, newspapers, little booklets, stuff like that, and just did the best that we could to sort of get people to understand why people would take such huge risks and extreme actions to protect the environment.
So pretty obviously you already knew that you had been under scrutiny at that point and would be. Nowadays, what does your life look like in general?
Nowadays? Well, yeah. I run Burning Books with two other people here in Buffalo, and it's a radical bookstore. You know, we do a lot of organizing out of here. We bring a lot of speakers in. It serves as sort of a local hub for, you know, political organizing around various issues. And more and more trying to get it to be sort of known nationally as a place where this type of thing goes on. So, you know, I run a bookstore. I have a family. Take care of my extended family. And that's kind of my life.
That sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
But hopefully rewarding. So what alerted you to a change in the status of your surveillance, and what do you think sparked this change?
Well, I stopped being involved in the press, in the Earth Liberation Front press office around 2002, summer of 2002. And, you know, since then I've been an activist, but much lower profile than that. And so I guess it was last September, which would have been September 2012. Yeah, September 2012. I first found out that there was an old friend and acquaintance of mine who was contacted by the FBI asking them all kinds of questions about me. The FBI officers who were contacting this person were here in Buffalo, and this person lived all the way on the other side of the country. And, you know, they were asking kind of leading questions, sort of things like, who does Leslie hang out with? Is Leslie capable of committing direct action or violent activity? Are you aware that he's stirring up the youth? And, you know, one of my favorites, of course, was the question of, do you know anyone who doesn't like Leslie who would be willing to talk to us? So that was the first thing I found out. And a couple weeks later, checked my mail, and in my mail was this like little memo that was clearly not meant to be there. It was an internal memo for the post office, coming from the a postmaster, whoever at the post office, to the person who would be delivering the mail or sorting the mail, saying that they wanted to, that they needed to photocopy all my mail prior to going out on the street. And it's a confidential on it, and it had a 30-day period written on it, which was currently active at the time. So I did a little research about that and got some lawyers together. And, you know, we figured out that what this was a mail cover, which is an official sort of program that the post office has where law enforcement agencies are able to apply to get a mail cover on an individual for various reasons. They need to argue it, and then it needs to be accepted by the postmaster. And, you know, once the mail cover is accepted, what they do is they photocopy the outside of any incoming mail, and they provide those photocopies to the law enforcement agency that requested the mail cover in the first place. So those two things happen. And fast forward to March, and find out that there was a grand jury subpoena here in Buffalo just for records, not to testify, not the normal type of grand jury that us activists usually talk about where someone's subpoenaed to testify, but it's it, documents were subpoenaed from an institution that we do business with here at the bookstore, and personally I do business with, and they wanted all files on me since 2011. So that was the third thing. And then finally, as I was taking a cross-country trip on an airplane, I found out pretty quickly that I was put on the secondary security screening selection list, which is a list that the TSA keeps that of people. At last I heard it was about 13,000 or 14,000 people in the U.S. that were on it. And it's not a no-fly list. You are actually allowed to fly, but you are put through the highest amount of security screening that they can come up with, chemical swab tests and pat-downs, and you have to go through the full body scanner, which you otherwise are able to sort of refuse to go through. And there's a little thing on your ticket that says SSSS, and if you don't know to look for it, you might miss it, and you might just think that it was a random check. But so then we got our legal team together, we did some fundraisers and raised some money, and got a lot of news coverage about it, New York Times front page article, local front page article here in the paper and in the weekly paper, and NBC Nightly News and stuff like that. We started filing Freedom of Information Act requests to see if we could get more information. So we started, trying to force the government to give us their files. And so we filed these requests with the post office and with the FBI and with TSA and with Executive Office of U.S. Attorneys. And we did some other formal complaints and things like that, anything the legal team could figure out. Mostly those requests were denied or not complied fully with. So now we're suing them. We're suing the FBI, we're suing the USPS and the TSA for failing to comply with the Freedom of Information Act. And I'm actually in court on Wednesday for the first stage of that lawsuit.
Damn, that's quite a procedure and a lot to sort of recognize over the course of 4 months. We're speaking with Leslie James Pickering, who's the former head of the Earth Liberation Front press office, as well as the author of several books about radical history in America. And we'll be right back after this musical break. Back to our conversation with Leslie James Pickering about recently discovered spate of investigations and surveillance into his mail and limitations to his travel abilities. So recent events in public discourse, such as the continued Snowden leaks on the NSA, have raised the issue of dragnet surveillance of the population in general. Some have used the metaphor of, quote, downloading the whole haystack to later find the needle, unquote. And one of the things that's come to light is that the U.S. Post Office is now often doing that without even, like, it sounded like from the reports that I heard from Snowden that it was a more regular thing, that they were that the NSA itself was photocopying all the mail that was going through and databasing it for later research.
Right, right.
Can you talk about these revelations and what they've meant for you as a radical activist who is already critical of civil liberties existing in the state?
Yeah. So, well, first, before I get into that, those sort of things coming out into the public eye were actually beneficial to me on a personal level, because it happened right as my whole thing was unfolding. And so that's part of the reason why I got such, large media coverage of my mail cover incident, was because at the same time these revelations were coming out nationally, and they needed sort of a personal face to put on the front of the New York Times about here's somebody who's actually getting their mail copied. But those are actually two totally different programs. The mail cover program has been in existence for well over 100 years. Many activists throughout many different, social justice struggles have been subject to various mail covers. It's been an ongoing thing. And it's so common that it's like, you know, you don't even hear about it. People don't even, most activists don't even really know about it, but it's been going on for so long. And in this case, this is a specific request from a specific law enforcement, yet unknown, but a specific law enforcement agency with a specific investigation that they're looking into, and they want this information for their investigation.
Assumingly tied to the federal records grand jury, right?
Assumingly it's all tied, yeah. I think that's a fair assumption, but at this point I don't have enough information to say what they're even investigating. But the sort of downloading the haystack to find the needle thing you talked about is a new program, it's a different thing, and it's just part of this switch, you know, this massive surveillance state that just keeps growing and growing, where they're doing just that, you know, gathering as much information as possible and just filing it, you know, in hopes that, like, maybe someday down the line it'll help out with some investigation somewhere, even though this is just everybody's mail all the time. But they're not, I guess the difference that I'm trying to point out is that with the mail cover, there's actually a law enforcement agency actively engaged in an investigation that wants this information and is receiving it. Versus with the downloading the haystack scenario, you know, this is just being stored somewhere, and it is possible it may come to be useful somewhere for some agency down the road, but they're not actually after you right now.
It's a more passive surveillance than the active pursuing one specific individual's patterns.
Right, and I'm not saying one is worse than the other in any way, but it is important to know that there's a distinction, and that this thing that I'm dealing with right now is actually not just part of this thing that everybody's mail is being copied on.
Has that brought more public support for your position of wanting transparency as to what the government's doing in terms of your communications and your ability to travel?
Yeah, actually, I would say so. I think that there's more support. You know, in the past, in the 90s, when I was dealing with a lot of repression for representing the press office, you know, there was kind of the notion that, well, he is involved with these people who are doing illegal stuff in some way or some form. You know, it's like, of course the FBI is going to be watching him. And there was that notion in my mind, too. And actually, back then, I had been given some evidence that there was a mail cover on me and my home at that point. And my response back then, and probably because around 2000, was just like, okay, that's part of the game. That's just another one of these things that I keep having to deal with. You know, of course they're watching. Like, this is the number one priority of the FBI. Like, of course they're doing this, and I just got to deal with it. Well, that is true in some way, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't fight back against it. And so part of the strategy that we had back then was, you know, really not that effective because you're not finding these little cracks in the system and trying to force them open. You're just like letting it go. And so this time around, you know, on one hand, I'm not, you know, a spokesperson for the ELF press office anymore, but on the other hand, I think that you just need to take whatever advantages you can and just milk them. And, you know, realistically, people are getting surveilled all over the world and more frequently in the U.S. all the time. And if we don't do anything about this, it's just going to get worse and worse, and that's what's been happening. And part of me thinks, like, well, I didn't do anything about this back around 2000, and now I am here in 2013, and it's worse. So it's a big deal for me to be like, okay, I'm going to do everything I can about this. I'm going to get a legal team together. We're going to file lawsuits. We're going to fight it. We're going to make a big deal out of it. Because it's kind of our duty.
And who knows? It might lead to a second church committee or something like that, right?
Well, it might be part of it, and it seems like it is part of, you know, the Snowden thing and everything else that's been going on with the NSA and all these revelations recently. I mean, it's like it is part of something bigger, and even if all that other stuff wasn't going on, it's still part of a bigger legacy of resisting, you know, resisting repression, resisting counterinsurgency and surveillance. And I think it reaches out to a certain audience of people that I wasn't able to reach when I was just representing the ELF to the press, you know, people who might not necessarily fully understand why the ELF was burning down corporate headquarters, but might understand why an activist would want to fight back against surveillance and harassment by the government.
Are there ways that people in the listening audience can be of support to you as you go through this case, or at least keep up on further steps that you take?
Yeah, our best information at this point, and like I said, it's been over a year now, is that this is really targeted not specifically just against me, but also against Burning Books, which is our bookstore and activist resource center here in Buffalo, which has really done a lot to sort of change the environment here in Buffalo and made a contribution nationally as well. And I mean, if people want to support me or support the work that we're doing against repression, state repression, one way to do that is to support Burning Books. We have a website, burningbooksbuffalo.com, and there's a lot of information on there about all the surveillance and harassment that we're dealing with. You can find information on there, and if you look around, you can find actually a way to donate to my legal team, which, as I said, is very aggressive and really doing everything that we can to push back as hard as we can against this. Another aspect that I haven't mentioned so far is that I'm mysteriously not allowed into Canada. And it's been that way, actually, for a number of years, and I've been trying to figure out what the deal is. And what we've been able to figure out so far is that around 2005, the FBI expanded its file sharing with the Canadian border authorities. And, of course, I had many, many interactions with FBI during my years with the ELF press office, including two full raids on my home and vehicle and workplace at two different times. And it must have been a person of interest at some level. And so, on the other hand, I don't have any convictions that would normally keep anyone out of Canada.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Did you have any, DUIs keep people out of Canada for a number of years.
Yeah, the way that it typically works is that if a conviction in the U.S. would translate into a felony conviction in Canada, so we might have a DUI here in the U.S., that's a misdemeanor. But they don't have that in Canada, so that means a DUI in the U.S. and you can't get into Canada. It's just an example. But, you know, there's certain crimes that would keep somebody out of Canada and certain convictions that would be fine. You're convicted for shoplifting or whatever, you can get into Canada. So, I have a number of convictions for protest activity. None of them really even come close to something that would keep someone out of Canada, let alone that they're all at least 10 years old, closer to 15 years old at this point. And their, typical thing is that if it's 5 years old or 10 years old, it's forgotten about. So it's really a mysterious sort of scenario that the only thing that ties the pieces together is this little bit of information that came out about the FBI's file sharing with the Canadian Border Authorities in 2005, which is right around the time they stopped letting me in. So there's a process that the Canadian government has called criminal rehabilitation, which doesn't really fit my situation, but it fits it as closely as we were able to figure out. So we're working through that process to try to see if we can resolve that issue as well. But it's expensive and it takes years to do so.
Well, 2005 would have been around the time of Operation Backfire coming up, right?
Yep.
So it makes sense that since at least one individual was able to escape into Canada who just came back, they were afraid of the same sort of thing with you, I guess.
I believe there were two people that were Canadian citizens within the whole roundup of Operation Backfire people, so there was a connection there with the Canadian government. But like I said, I've been somebody who's engaged in free speech. It might be controversial. It might be associated with activities that are illegal, but it's just free speech, and that's what free speech is meant to be, in theory. So I guess, in this country, speech is free until you start saying something that they don't want you to say. I guess my main thing right now is that we need to fight back as hard as we can on all fronts. I first started dealing with the FBI when I was 19 years old. When I was running the press office, I was young, young, eager activist, and willing to put myself out there. And my first interaction was them coming onto our yard and telling me and another person that we were walking on thin ice, that we were, on a one-way trip to prison, and that they were going to get us, more or less. And it was a very threatening situation. Everything since then, back in those years, was very threatening and intimidating, and they're always telling us we were going to spend the rest of our lives in prison. We dealt with 7 grand jury subpoenas back in the 90s and 1 congressional subcommittee subpoena. It was an intense period, and you know, I always look back and I think like, oh, I wish I could have done more of this or more of that or more of this or more of that. But you know what? There's all this stuff going on now. It may not seem like as intense a period right now, but you got to take every opportunity you have and fight back as hard as you can. And so, you know, this might not be as exciting for me as, say, seeing Boise Cascade burn to the ground, but I see this as an opportunity as well, and I'm going to fight as hard as I can and get as much support as I can in any way that's available to me. And I think that that's what people should take out of this in general, is don't be intimidated. You know, this government acts like it can do anything to any of us at any time that it wants, but really we're the ones with all the power. And if we, you know, work hard and fight hard and team up, we can really change this system and really take this government out very quickly and easily. It's just a matter of us getting our minds around it. And so part of what I'm trying to do is just show an example of somebody who's you know, not going to just sort of bow down to the fear that they're trying to instill in people. Really fight back. I'm trying to set an example of someone who's fighting back.
Kind of a little bit off topic, but I'd like to hear your comment on it. Jeremy Hammond was sentenced to 10 years in prison for charges of hacking the private security firm Stratfor, as well as infiltrating government and law enforcement support websites yesterday. Do you have any comments on that?
I mean, just like, just basically in love with Jeremy Hammond right now. He's, you know, facing quite a bit of personal consequence for something that he did, and he is not backing down. You know, he's making a firm stance, and I find that very, very commendable. I think that, you know, he's got his head screwed on straight. He's very focused, and he's not going to be giving up. And it's the kind of example that we need. A major aspect of this kind of repression of throwing people in prison for 10 years or more, or, you know, spying on people, is that they want us to be too afraid to do anything against what they're doing. And Jeremy has set an example of somebody who's not going to be intimidated, you know, by prison sentences or anything else. He realizes what he did, why he did it, and he still believes in it. And I'm right there with him. I mean, what that hack was amazing. And I think that more people need to do that kind of thing more often. It doesn't necessarily need to be all illegal activity, but you need to do what you can and take the resources that you've got and fight back against this. I mean, this is our world that we're living in. And if we're not going to fight back against all this repression and all this devastation that's going on around us, and, you know, then we're just giving up. And I think Jeremy Hammond is a great example of somebody who's out there, who's not giving up, who's fighting back, and who's setting sort of the right track for all of us to take.
We're speaking with Leslie James Pickering, who's the former head of the Earth Liberation Front Press Office, as well as the author of several books about radical history in America. And we'll be right back after this musical break. back with Leslie James Pickering to talk about radical history in America and the potential to feed current and future struggle. You seem to take a lot of strength from a history of resistance and sort of looking back to the past of what people have done in the past, what they could have done, and where it's gotten us now. And you've written a couple of books that work to flesh out radical history that may have been left behind for many of us. Mm-hmm. Last year you published, I believe it was last year, you published The Emetic, Burning Books in Buffalo and Eberhardt in Portland. Can you talk briefly about this group and what brought you to decide to write a short book on it?
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, it's great for me to hear just what you said, because that's exactly what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to pull out pieces of history that set an example of how we got here to this place we are now, to contextualize us in the struggle now and realize that this stuff has happened in the past. It can serve as an inspiration and lessons, both positive and negative lessons from the past that we need to learn. And so that's a great example. The Evan Meckham Equal Terrorist International Conspiracy, or Emetic, was a group, a clandestine underground group in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, in the Grand Canyon region, who were fighting to protect lands that were sacred to various American Indian, Native American tribes and nations out there in that part of the country. And at the time, a lot of that land was being threatened by especially nuclear development, uranium mining, but also ski slope expansion and some other things that were going on out there at the time. So this group, sort of taking inspiration from Edward Abbey's Monkey Wrench Gang, and some of these people were involved in Earth First, the early version of Earth First, where people were doing very small-scale, frequent monkey wrenching against all kinds of environmental perpetrators. And they were taking it to the next level. So they would down power lines that were feeding to and from, you know, uranium mines or nuclear power, and they would down ski lifts that were, at the Fairfield Snowball Ski Resort, which was expanding onto the San Francisco Peaks, which is a sacred mountain range out there in that region. And they kind of just, I mean, to make it really simple, you know, they figured out how to use a cutting torch, and they found some targets and figured out some things that they could cut down, you know, power lines and ski lifts. And then they would go out and do this, and then they would make a communique, write up a communique, and they would get it out in the press. And, you know, they became a local sensation for a while. And when the FBI and other law enforcement eventually did capture them, they tried very hard to wrap up the leadership of Earth First, especially Dave Foreman, into a larger conspiracy involving this group, involving funding and leading this group, which really wasn't accurate, really wasn't the case. But they were really trying to take down both the sort of underground and the above ground aspects of the radical environmental movement. And so for me, having had this like very intense, very close, you know, relationship with radical environmental underground efforts in a decade later, and not really knowing the details of that history, it was a big deal for me to sort of flesh those out and put it out there in the public to say, hey, you know, there was something before the Earth Liberation Front, you know, and there'll be something after it, and after that, there'll be something after that. You know, the struggle is continuing, that it's ongoing, as it passes from generation to generation, that we're always going to be fighting, that we'll never give up. And so I think it was really important to sort of get that history down on paper, because as somebody who really should have known all those details back in the 90s, I know exactly how little I did know. It was like, it's painfully evident about how little I actually knew about that situation. And this group very directly spawns the sort of activity and ideology that the Earth Liberation Front came out of. So, you know, my objective there is to really get that information out, to get people to learn those lessons and apply them in a positive way next time around, and to realize that we're part of a continuum of struggle.
And I think that there's a really official narrative that attempts to delegitimize and also to make people feel isolated when they feel like upset and enraged by what they see going on around them. And by taking away elements of these histories, they feel like they're just a little speck on the timeline that doesn't have any precursors and won't have any sort of legacy.
Right, like you said, right. And you get these sort of fictionalized versions of what went down that are put out in the media And in the long run, a lot of times the public consciousness just takes that and leaves, you know, you have all these ideas of things that happened in the 60s, bombings, whatever that happened in the 60s, and you always have this concept that all these people died in an accident and stuff like that. And that's because of all these movies that came out and all these like made-for-TV docudramas that came out, you know, defaming groups like the Weather Underground, the George Jackson Brigade, and sort of like adding non-historical twist to that that would just add a drama to the film. And so I think it's important to get the real history out so people really know what happened.
I was actually thinking this morning, because I was looking at some of the ABC websites in the U.S., and there is one documentary that I've seen about the UFF, United mm-hmm. Freedom Fighters.
Mm-hmm. Ohio 7.
The Ohio 7. I haven't seen or heard anything else about that group except for on political prisoner support sites.
Right. Unfortunately, there's a lot of things like that. There's a lot of groups like that. And if I had enough time and enough years, hopefully I'll be able to do something about some of those groups. I mean, that's one group in particular that I would love to do a project on because they had an amazing history. And it's really inspirational and empowering. And it happened during a set of years that people look back at now and think we're like just all about apathy and consumerism. But realistically, you know, all this stuff was happening as well. And I think that needs to be part of our history and our understanding of our history.
Can you say a little quick something about who Evan Meckham was?
Evan Meckham was actually a governor of Arizona who was, you know, got in, and I detail this in the booklet, but, you know, he got in office through this, like, set of freak circumstances, and he was very sort of evangelical, far-right. I thought he had conversations with God, and he was very unliked by the Arizona population once he was in office. There was all kinds of corruption, nepotism, stuff like that. He eventually got kicked out of office because of money laundering or something like that. And he became sort of like, you know, the liberal perception of George Bush during those years that he was president, he was an embarrassment. Well, for Arizona, he was, Evan Meckham was quite an embarrassment. They had a whole boycott of their entire tourism industry for the whole state. He tried to outlaw Martin Luther King Jr. Day statewide. You know, he used racial terms publicly, stuff like that. So anyway, it became a joke for this, you know, for this underground sort of eco-guerrilla group to poke fun at, you know, saying that he was responsible or that he was somehow directing this group or that they were in support of him or with him in some way. And that was kind of their whole shtick, you know, to an extent, was that, you know, that there was a lot of comical, they were very lighthearted. While they were doing this highly illegal activity, they were also very lighthearted and, you know, appealed to people in a, like, sort of very personal way.
We are speaking with Leslie James Pickering, who's the former head of the Earth Liberation Front press office, as well as the author of several books about radical history in America. And we'll be right back after this musical break. Back with Leslie James Pickering to talk about radical history in America and the potential to feed current and future struggle. Another book that you wrote, and kind of in this vein of forgotten history, is a biography of Samuel Melville entitled mm-hmm. Mad Bomber Melville. Who was Samuel Melville and what did he do?
He was actually a bit, you know, this is back during the anti-Vietnam War era, sort of the hippie protest period. Sam was a bit older than most of the college students that were engaged in that. He was in his early to mid-30s, and, you know, they were mostly in their early 20s. But he was very passionate about stopping the war. He came from a working-class background. He actually grew up outside of Buffalo here, where I'm at now, and moved, you know, relocated to New York City and got involved in a lot of organizing against Vietnam and other issues that were going on at the time, including being very involved in the Columbia sort of uprisings that were happening then. And He was very upset with the way the world was going. He was very upset with the war. He felt like we needed a full-blown revolution And he was willing to make personal, extreme personal sacrifices to try to bring those things on and make those changes happen. And so at one point, there was some people from a French-Canadian separatist group that were running from the Canadian authorities, and he took them in, and he tried to learn sort of bomb-making and bomb-setting skills and techniques from them and apply them in the U.S., and then he helped smuggle them into Cuba, where they eventually landed, and then he went on a campaign which preceded the Weather Underground and was more devastating in many ways than a lot of the than any of the actions that the Weather Underground took. He got his hands on some dynamite, and he planted timed dynamite bombs in corporate headquarters all over Manhattan, and it just kept escalating to the point where the night before he was arrested, he did three simultaneous corporate bombings. All these corporations were involved in the Vietnam War, were getting money and funding the Vietnam War, and Chase Manhattan and General Motors and Rockefeller Center. And it became a very, very big thing for the NYPD bomb squad and the New York sort of activist scene, progressive, radical, revolutionary scene in general. And it became a big inspiration for what later became the Weather Underground. At that point, they were the Weathermen. They were still protesting, and they were fighting in street protests and stuff like that, but they hadn't taken to going completely underground and bombing yet. Excuse me. But so eventually Sam did get captured, and he got sent to Attica Prison, which is upstate New York maximum security prison. And he started organizing in Attica. At that point there were a handful of people who were at least becoming politicized, and a growing number of people who were getting political in the Attica prison. Before you know it, they were leading up to the famed Attica prison uprising in September of 1971, the biggest prison uprising in U.S. history, where they took over the prison for 5 days, and over 40 people were killed in the retaking of the prison, including Sam Melville. So he was identified as a leader, picked out, and more or less assassinated under some unclear circumstances. But again, his history, I thought, was important to learn, because we have all these sort of inaccurate notions of that era. We have these ideas that there are all these white people that were involved, and maybe they were even underground and bombing, but they were all privileged white people. The whole thing about the Weather Underground, they were all a bunch of rich kids. They were all sort of rebelling against their parents. I mean, there may have been some of that. There certainly was some of that, but that wasn't the whole story at all, and it's not Sam Melville's story whatsoever. And so wanted to show that this history, working class struggle, not just against the Vietnam War, but in support of the Black Panther Party and for like a full-blown revolution in the United States, was taken up by this group of people, and that it led to this like incredible situation where even after capture and imprisonment, Sam was able to still organize and still fight and still create this enormously significant situation, which he then gave his life for. Again, if we don't know about these things that happened, and then the next generation comes along and tries to organize and doesn't know about the things that we are capable of and the way that we've made mistakes in the past, then they're just going to keep making the same mistakes, and we're not going to be able to win and get an advantage. So I think it's really important to know this history and learn from it and act on that.
Besides filing lawsuits against the federal government, do you have any other things that you're writing through right now, or just sort of dealing with the stuff as it comes to you?
I'm actually engaging in a couple sort of bigger, more long-term projects. I'd like to do something that's more of a narrative history on some of the ELF stuff. Like I said, there's a number of different guerrilla groups that I think that it's like really important for people to have information available on. Daniel Burton Rose wrote Guerrilla USA on the George Jackson Brigade recently, and in there, Ward Churchill does an introduction to the book, and he's saying the same thing that I'm trying to say right now, which is that there's all these amazingly inspirational moments in U.S. history, these people who sacrificed their lives, who fought and had some major victories, and there's very little bit about that out there in the public. And so there's many groups that would like to be able to put the time and energy and resources into it. Unfortunately, you don't really make any living off of writing radical history.
Yeah.
But I'm working on a number of projects, and I'm constantly doing Freedom Information Act requests just to get pieces of history so that I can put things together.
Well, I look forward to seeing some more stuff that you've written. I enjoyed the very concise and to-the-point article that you wrote in Fifth Estate.
Oh, good.
I thought
that
was good. Yeah.
I guess I just like to say that along the lines of everything I've been saying, that's exactly what we're trying to do here at Burning Books. We hunt down books and DVDs and booklets and audio recordings and posters and anything that we can on freedom struggle from all different kinds of sources. We don't just, many bookstores just have like one wholesaler that they go through. We deal with anyone, anywhere, and we try to gather up as much as we can about freedom struggle in particular and have it available to people so that these histories, this information is out there and available to people. And I think that the more that we know, the more powerful we are. I see it as a legacy, sort of it follows in the footsteps of what I've done with the press office. And a lot of the stuff I wasn't a whole lot of forethought in, but as I go on in years, I realize that like these things build, and if we keep working and keep struggling and keep fighting, then sort of our victories accumulate in a way. And with the press office, I'm essentially trying to get information out there about like, there is this underground group. If you're not content with voting, if you're not content with holding a sign and doing civil disobedience, well, there is another way to fight back, and this group is doing it. And that's the same thing that I'm doing now with this bookstore, and that's the same thing that I'm doing with my writing projects. And I pretty much see that as being what I'm going to be doing the rest of my life.
The way that you phrase that actually reminded me of one thing that I don't really have a good way of asking about it, but when I heard Radical Bookstore and Buffalo, I remembered the Christie
Martin Foster.
That could be was yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about him if you know anything?
Yeah, totally. His name is Martin Foster, and he used to own actually more than one bookstore in Buffalo. It started with one bookstore called the East West Bookstore, which is over on the east side, which is still pretty much an entirely African American community. And this was in the mid to late 60s, I think 67, if I'm not mistaken, there was, one of those sort of race riots that, people know about the Detroit one, but there were many other race riots during that time period, and there was a big one here in Buffalo. And during it, Martin had his radical bookstore going over there, and he would bring people in off the street who, most of the people who were out on the street, they were just like, fighting the cops and fighting out the sort of white businesses that were like vampires in their community. So he would bring them in, allow them in to get out of the tear gas, and then, read them some Malcolm X or something like that, or show them the Black Panther Party newsletter, and politicize these young people, and then send them right back out on the street. And it became a target of local law enforcement, of the police department here. He had, before he started his bookstore, he had done a prison bid, and got released to Buffalo. I think it was over a drug conviction when he was younger. And so when the police got together and tried to figure out what they could do about Martin Suster, now that he's got this radical bookstore, they came up with a scheme to frame him up on drug charges, on drug dealing charges. And they got an agent to go in and sort of go up to the counter while they were secretly taking photographs and sort of play around with a little glassine envelope or whatever. And, they accumulated enough circumstantial evidence to convince the jury that he was dealing drugs on there and sent him back to prison. So Martin went back to prison, actually went to Attica, not during the riot, but had a number of really groundbreaking lawsuits allowing prisoners to get radical literature in prison and a number of other things about, we're really pushing forward for prisoner rights and being able to have that literature and having that sense of like those minor legal victories was something that made a big deal in Attica, actually, in Attica leading up to the prison riot uprising that was going on there. And just being able to have a Black Panther Party newsletter, being able to be politicized and talk about politics And Martin actually has a number of groundbreaking cases for prisoner rights. And he was eventually, his conviction was actually eventually overturned, but he had to agree to the stipulation, never come back to Buffalo. So he's still alive. He lives in New York City. He's quite elderly now, from what I understand. But he's an inspiration to us here. And, you know, there is a legacy of radical booksellers and bookstores here in Buffalo, and Martin is one, and we're definitely one.
Stirring up the youth indeed.
Yeah.
How do you spell his last name?
S-O-S-T-R-E.
T-R-E. Because that movie used to be up, at least, on the Christie Books video page.
Oh, a film about him?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was called Frame Up. I have a VHS copy we show here at the bookstore from time to time, but I don't know how available it is. See if you can find it.
That'd be a great thing to get digitized if no one else has a copy.
Yeah, actually, I think the company that owns it is still in business, and so I was able to buy a copy straight from the company that has the rights to it, but it was a VHS copy. So
yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
Well, thanks for that.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me, Leslie James Pickering, about your recent encounters with law enforcement and older encounters with law enforcement and history and the importance of history and struggle and keeping on keeping on.
I guess. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course.
Thanks for doing the show.
Yeah, of course. You take care.
Take care.
Bye. Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California. The show is sponsored by the worker owners at Firestorm Books and Cafe at 48 Commerce Street in downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Firestorm features organic coffee and milks, vegan sandwiches, homemade baked goods, radical literature, and a community calendar that can be found online at firestormcafe.com. Archives of past interview episodes of The Final Straw can be found on thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can find archives of past music episodes on archive.org and Radio for All by searching Final Straw Asheville FM. The show airs every Sunday on Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org, at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And if you have any concerns, questions, criticisms, or critiques, feel free to send them to us at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Have a great week.